were running along the lakeshore and got thrown into the water, and trees kind of toppling on top of us.
A Sitka couple narrowly escapes a landslide. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 13th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the most active volcano in Alaska is erupting again.
In the past, eruptions of Pavlov have gone on for 4, 6, 8 weeks.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Two Sitkans are safe after a massive landslide destroyed the cabin they were camping in Sunday morning. An air taxi pilot rescued the pair from a debris field estimated to be 20 feet deep. All their belongings were buried in the slide, and their dog remains missing. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Kevin Knox and his girlfriend Maggie Gallen were staying at Redoubt Lake, a popular Forest Service recreation cabin about 15 miles southwest of Sitka. The cabin is located at the head of the valley and is surrounded by steep mountain slopes and rocky cliffs that climb 4,000 feet above the surface of the lake. Knox says the mountainside behind the cabin was showing signs of instability the previous evening.
There'd been a lot of rock activity off of this one slide that was off back behind the cabin all night on Saturday night, and I was just kind of watching some of it. It was just small rocks kind of tumbling off and falling down and making a lot of racket.
The next morning, Knox and Gallen went out on the lake in the rowboat provided by the Forest Service to do a little fishing. The mountainside came down as they returned to shore at about 11 a.m.
We had just tied the boat up and Maggie was in the cabin, and then it just let loose huge piece off of the side of the mountain back behind the cabin. And I yelled for Maggie to run, get out of the cabin, and we started running down the beach.
Redoubt Lake is a glacier-carved fjord. It's just a few feet above sea level. What passes for a beach there is just a narrow strip of pebbles. Knox and Gallen did not have much room to make their escape as old-growth timber, mud, and rock began to press down the valley.
We were running along the lakeshore and got thrown into the water, and trees kind of toppling on top of us, and we both popped up about 3 or 4 feet from each other, and you know, the situation kind of got our wits about us enough and just tried to hunker down.
Knox and Gallen were soaked to the skin. The cabin and all their belongings were under a debris field Knox thinks is about 20 feet deep. They wrung out clothes and tried to shelter as best they could until their scheduled pickup 3 hours later. They also spent time calling for Luna, Knox's 10-year-old border collie.
She was in between Maggie and I as we were running down the beach. I think she thought it was a little bit of a game because I was yelling, run, go, go. And she jumped up and nipped at my sleeve. And so I know she was right there. And it's just, I kept laying in bed last night thinking, you know, how did we get through it? And she didn't.
The couple flew back to look for Luna on Monday morning, but there was no sign of her. Because of the instability of the slide area, the pilot chose not to land the float plane. The slide originated 600 feet up the mountainside and is about 200 yards wide. The lake's inlet stream, Knox says, is beginning to carve a new channel through the debris field. Knox is grateful to Harris Air and pilot Mark Hackett in particular for putting his plane down and looking for them on Sunday in marginal conditions. Knox says he signaled Hackett by waving his bright yellow raincoat. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska's most active volcano appears to be erupting. Mount Pavlov on the Alaska Peninsula started rumbling this morning, according to Alaska Volcano Observatory scientist in charge John Power.
This type of pattern, weak seismic activity along with a great deal of heat at the summit, has characterized past eruptions of Pavlov, and we believe that's what's occurring now.
Scientists haven't been able to get a good look at the volcano, but Power suspects it's oozing lava, or perhaps even shooting jets of it into the air in what's called a Stromboli fountain. So far, the observatory hasn't detected any ash clouds associated with the eruption, although in the past, Pavlov has produced significant plumes.
2007, during that eruption, there were ash clouds up to 15,000 to 18,000 feet, and certainly we've had much larger ones out of Pavlov in the past. Although this type of activity we're seeing today is not uncharacteristic of Pavlov to have sort of, lower level, less energetic eruptions of lava as well.
Pavlov has a real-time monitoring network, which Power says the observatory will be keeping a close eye on in the days and weeks to come. King Cove and Cold Bay are the nearest communities to the 8,000-foot volcano. A fatal accident that took the life of a bulldozer driver near Stefan Lake Lodge, north of Talkeetna, on Friday occurred only hours after a State Department of Natural Resources team had flown over the site on an inspection tour. The work is being done to build an airstrip to support studies on the Susitna Dam project. Rick Thompson, South Central Regional Land Manager with DNR's Division of Mining, Land, and Water, says his team went to review the project on Friday in response to calls from local residents who were concerned about the damage the work was doing to the terrain. Thompson says he didn't see anything wrong with the work.
Yeah, they had already accomplished, I don't know how many miles, several miles of work across public and private land at that point. And we flew the route that they had already accomplished and did not see any problems. In fact, we think the conditions were still pretty good. And then they were heading up into the Alpine country from that point on Friday. And there was even, more snow. The conditions were still good up there, very good. So we were not alarmed by what we saw as far as the conditions that they were operating under, nor did we find any problems with the work that had been performed to that point.
But later, a D6 bulldozer driven by 72-year-old Donald Keel crashed through the ice on a lake. The operator was killed in the accident. Thompson says the DNR team had left the area before the accident occurred. He says DNR had issued a cross-country travel permit to the operation, which is good through May 15th. The permit is still valid, he says, despite the fatality. The work on the Cat Train was being done by a Wasilla company, Alaska Diversified Services. A website for the company lists landscaping, snow plowing, light home remodeling, and maintenance as its services. A call to the company was not returned. Local resident Mike Woods, who has been vocal in his opposition to the work, said today that the bulldozer went into what is known as a kettle lake, or a small pond on the tundra that normally does not freeze over very solidly and then is obscured by blown snow. The federal government is predicting a normal wildfire season in Alaska this year, but as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, it could be later than normal.
The nation as a whole is below normal for fire activity thus far this year. That's because most early fires rage through the eastern U.S. Frequent precipitation here in the east has downgraded that threat. In parts of Alaska, the late snowfall is having the same effect. Jeremy Sullins is an analyst at the government's National Interagency Fire Center.
As we move through May, there's below normal conditions in southern Alaska because of the late snowpack.
Sullins says the snowpack will melt away fairly soon, but it could delay the typical start of the fire season. Last August, a fire south of Fairbanks torched more than 40,000 acres. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the connection between food and culture.
Some people like fry it and fry their muktuk like a stir fry with rice.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do you put like soy sauce or anything?
Yeah, you could put soy sauce on it.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Start a meaningful career with a bachelor's degree in elementary or special education from home or on campus from the University of Alaska Southeast. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Alaskans who make an annual habit of digging for razor clams on the Kenai Peninsula may have noticed something odd over the last few years. There just doesn't seem to be as many clams on the beaches as there used to be. As KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports, scientists have also noticed the trend.
There aren't many people out on the beach at the moment, although it's a gorgeous early summer day. Maybe that's because the next really good clamming tides are still a few days away. When the tides on Nanilchik area beaches are low, you can expect to see lots of folks down here, buckets and clam shovels in hand, eagerly searching for the telltale bubble on the surf of the sand that lets them know where to dig.
Oh, I love to clam dig. It's mesmerizing. It's kind of a zen, you know.
That's Homer fish and game biologist Carol Kirkvliet, who has been studying razor clams all along the eastern side of Cook Inlet for many years. That research includes collecting and examining samples of clams and performing aerial surveys to count how many people are going clamming every year and where they are finding success. In the fall of 2010, it was discovered that a large winter storm had caused a major die-off of the razor clam population on the popular clamming beaches around Nanilchik. Kirkvliet says that since that time, Fish and Game has been working with Alaska Pacific University professor Brad Harris and his students to study the clams more closely. She says the initial study showed that the abundance of razor clams was still quite high following the storm, but the clams that were left were smaller and only represented one age class. The lifespan of razor clams is about 5 to 8 years, but they can sometimes live as long as 14 years. In the second year of their study, between 2011 and 2012, Harris and his students discovered that the Nanilchik area clam population had dropped by as much as 50%. But why?
I would say not any kind of smoking gun.
Harris says there is still much that is not known about the lives of razor clams. For instance, questions like how long do clams stay at sea before attempting to take root in the beach sand? How are clams located on different beaches related to one another? And how much effect do local clammers have on the overall population?
So we are really in a place where we're trying to track this population. And at the same time, my students and I are looking at what these potential mechanisms might be. But we're really just scratching the surface.
Harris says some possible answers to the razor clam decline include climatic changes in Cook Inlet and an increase in the population of sea otters. But he stresses that right now, scientists do not have enough information to make a definitive determination. Since Harris and his students have only been working the Nanilchik beaches for the last 3 years, Carol Kirkvliet agrees that it's too early to tell what might be causing the population decline in razor clams.
Well, it's hard to say if it's unusual or not. You know, we've estimated abundance periodically on these beaches, but we haven't estimated abundance sequentially every single year and on the same beach. So whether it's a natural phenomenon or we're still looking at the data to evaluate it and see what it all means.
The good news is that thanks to the APU study, scientists are getting the best data they've ever had about the lives of razor clams. Fish and Game hasn't taken management action on the clam fishery in the last few years, but Kirkvliet says that could change soon.
We're discussing what actions we may take. We're basically looking at the data and seeing what the data suggests that we should be doing next.
Kirkvliet says that if any action is taken this year, it would likely happen before the upcoming Memorial Day weekend. Reporting from Homer and waiting for a good clamming tide myself, I'm Aaron Selbig.
A Canadian mining company is pulling out of an exploration project near Tok. The move comes as the price of gold has fallen about 15% from unprecedented highs in recent years, and as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, may signal a slowdown in the mining industry.
Officials with Vancouver-based Heatherdale Resources were pretty optimistic a couple of years ago about the potential of the Delta project. Initial exploration at the site, about 36 miles west of Tok, showed promising deposits of gold, silver, copper, and zinc. But Heatherdale President and CEO Patrick Smith says company officials decided a couple of weeks ago that given the falling price of gold and, more importantly, the availability of investors, it's time to get out of the Delta Project and focus instead on Heatherdale's other, more promising prospect in Alaska, the Niblack Project near Ketchikan.
We came to the conclusion that money is tight, if you will, in our industry, in our sector of the industry, and therefore Niblack was the project that deserved the funding.
Smith says exploration at Niblack is farther along, and it's showing potentially rich deposits of precious and base metals, and that will attract more investors than a prospect that's in the early stages of exploration, like the Delta Project.
Your advanced stage exploration projects like Niblack have a much better opportunity to find money to keep those projects moving, as opposed to something that's, you know, early stage exploration that really is more speculative.
Smaller and mid-size mineral exploration companies depend on such speculation by investors. But Kurt Freeman, who runs a mining consultant firm in Fairbanks, says those investors aren't putting their money into risky ventures such as mining exploration these days. He says the global risk capital market has sharply declined over the past 6 months due to investors' growing concerns over the health of the world's economies.
U.S. economy, the European economy, other economies around the world that are suffering for any number of reasons. And that risk capital comes from investors who, when they see that risk is becoming too high, they pull that highest risk capital off the table.
And that's going to cause a steep drop in mineral exploration expenditures in Alaska to around half of the 2010 peak of about $300 million, says Freeman, president of Avalon Development Corporation. It may be too early for Freeman's prediction of a slump in mineral exploration to be reflected in the number of mining permits issued by the State Department of Natural Resources. Jeff Rogers, a geologist with the department's mining division office in Fairbanks, says that trend seems to be headed in the other direction.
The number of permitted exploration projects is increasing.
Rogers says the agency issued 108 permits last year, up from 92 in 2011. He says 53 have been issued so far this year. But he says the number of permits issued doesn't necessarily indicate the level of exploration that actually takes place out in the field.
A lot of folks will put in for permits and then never do anything.
There are lots of permits being submitted both last year and so far this year. But some of those are simply permits put in so that if the financial markets change for the better, your permits will be in hand and you can get to work.
Freeman also thinks many permits issued this year are for smaller operations, such as placer mines. He says big established mining operations like the Kinross, Fort Knox, and Sumitomo Pogo gold mines that aren't dependent on risk capital are making big profits, despite a 15% drop in the price of gold over the past 6 months, down to about $1,475 an ounce. But Freeman says the slump in exploration this year causes concern among those big operators because it will set back the discovery of new deposits and slow down Alaska's mining industry for the next few years.
When you put on the brake and say, okay, I'm not spending, people disappear, expertise disappears, they go elsewhere, they go wherever the work happens to be.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Start a meaningful career with a bachelor's degree in elementary or special education from home or on campus from the University of Alaska Southeast. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Breakup could slow down this week as cold air returns to the interior. National Weather Service meteorologist Scott Berg says a cold front is rapidly moving across the region.
Went through our area overnight last night, and it's going to move into the eastern part of the state and over the eastern Alaska Range and the 40-mile country. They could see several inches of snow, especially at the higher elevations.
Berg says high spots like American Summit on the Taylor Highway near Eagle could get 2 to 8 inches of snow overnight tonight, but he says any lower elevation snow should melt as it hits the ground. A winter storm warning is in effect for the upper Tanana Valley, 40 Mile Country, and the eastern Alaska Range through tomorrow afternoon. A winter weather advisory for 1 to 3 inches of snow has been issued for the Delta and Tanana Flats. Berg says temperatures across the interior will be on the cool side this week.
Our temperatures are going to be near record lows today, tomorrow, and then we actually might even see some record low highs.
Temperatures are also colder than normal in South Central Alaska. National Weather Service meteorologist Chris Burling says temperatures in recent days in South Central have been a few degrees below normal, and he says a low pressure system over mainland Alaska will hold for several more days. This week's forecast for Anchorage is for cloudy or partly sunny weather with periods of rain.
It does look at least through the short term here, at least through next week, we are going to be remaining in this colder pattern.
Burling says South Central Alaska temperatures will stay in the 40s and 50s, but the area could see some late season snow Friday or Saturday. The start of the tourist season in interior Alaska is coming up, and Denali National Park will be ready despite lingering snow cover. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The National Park Service is scheduled to open Denali's entrance area facilities like the Visitor Center May 15th. Park spokeswoman Chris Pfister says the popular Denali sled dog demonstration is also set to begin that day.
One big challenge for that has been that the sled dog track that typically we use a wheeled sled for during the demonstrations has been snow covered, and we are trying to remove that snow. I mean, this is ironic.
Pfister says the short circular track is harder to handle on a real sled, adding that the interpreters who do the demonstration are typically not mushers and are trained on a wheeled rig. Meanwhile, road clearing is pushed to the Isleson Visitor Center at mile 66 of the 92-mile park road.
There's a large drift just past Isleson that they have to bully through, maybe 18 feet deep. But then beyond that, typically, the snow levels are less. And so they're not anticipating having huge amounts of problems getting the rest of the way to Kantishna.
The park road is open to public vehicles to Teklanika at mile 30 through May 18th, then only to mile 15 for the rest of the summer. Most campgrounds along the park road will be open by May 20th, except for Wonder Lake at the end of the road, which opens June 8th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Some people crave ice cream or fresh vegetables or pasta. Others prefer dried fish or caribou. As part of our series exploring culture in rural and urban Alaska, APRN's Ann Hillman found out how strong links between food and culture are common throughout the state.
Paul Wilkins stands in his tiny kitchen in his East Anchorage home, chopping herbs to spread on his homemade breadsticks.
It's buffalo wing sauce with jalapenos and cilantro and mozzarella cheese.
He's testing a new recipe to share with his friend for her birthday.
Cooking for somebody is one way to make them happy, to make them enjoy things.
Food brings people together. And he says cooking and food are also part of his identity.
I guess I define myself based on the things that I like to do and the things that I am, and so therefore food is part of that because I like to cook different things or taste different things or eat different things.
It's also part of his cultural identity. He cooks lasagna and manicotti because his Italian mother prepared it throughout his childhood. He's learning more about Southern foods from his father's side of the family. But not everyone has that family connection.
There's tons of kids that grow up just eating at strip malls and going to McDonald's and Red Robin, and they're great restaurants, but you know, I'm sure a lot of that in some families, some of that home-cooked meal history is kind of lost a little bit, I would guess.
That can happen even in areas of Alaska without restaurants.
When I was a teenager, I was in high school, I was going away from my food. You know, like any other teenager, having the candy, the chips, and all that.
Dorcas Nasoluk from Nuiqsut says she stopped eating whale and caribou, traditional Inupiaq foods, and eventually she started feeling less healthy. It was a mantra repeated by Inupiaq of all ages. If we eat too much food from the outside instead of local native foods, we get sick. When Dasulak had her baby, she decided to go back to eating traditional foods.
I give it to my daughter, my little three-year-old. I grew up with it, so I'm letting her grow up with it. She loves it. She can't get over it. That's how we all are raised, eating up the land.
Dasulak and others stressed that for the Inupiat, food is directly tied to culture. And like all cultures, it's constantly evolving and being influenced by outside sources. Hazel Kanakanon says that people certainly don't just eat raw muktuk. They incorporate food traditions from outside of Alaska.
You know, like my grandma, she used to like it fried, you know, with onions and stuff. So that was good. Some people like fry it and fry their muktuk like a stir fry with rice.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do you put like soy sauce or anything?
Yeah, you could put soy sauce on it.
And just because she's committed to eating and teaching about native foods, it doesn't mean she'll eat everything, like caribou head.
My grandma used to, you know, I was like the, you know, the tutu head. They cook the brains with the tongue and the, you know, you boil it. And so I never tried it before, but, you know, most of my kids liked it because my husband grew up with it.
Yeah. But you don't do it.
I don't even.
How come?
I don't know. I grew up with, you know, with my grandma, you know, with all the Inupiat food, but it's just me, I just don't eat it.
April Phillip is a student at Ilisavik College in Barrow. She says she would love to eat more of her native foods from Bethel. Her Yupik family sends her dried fish in a gudeg. But she often only has time to microwave a hot pocket and get to class. And though eating her native foods ties her to her family, it's not quite the same.
My Yupik family, for instance, isn't, you know, they're not around to, and you don't like hear the normal words that you would hear at the dinner table. But I do feel like closer to home.
Back at Wilkins' home, he pulls the breadsticks out of the oven. Just like Phillips and others around Alaska, he feels the same relationship between culture and food.
The food that people eat sort of partially defines the way their culture has evolved over millennia, really.
He says that it's already helped define the culture for many Alaska natives, and only time will tell how it will define Alaska's urban areas. For APRN, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Tim Ellis in Delta, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ann Hillman in Nooksit. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast has accounting degrees online to prepare students with the skills required by Alaska's industries. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.